The next case on our calendar, 05-1159, Dayton Bar Association versus Wayne Steffen. Mr. Lepla.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Moyer, Justices, Mr. Tuss, Mr. Steffen, my name is Gary Lepla. I'm proud to represent Wayne Steffen here today, and he is seated at council table. We particularly appreciate the opportunity to be heard under the circumstances. Come before the court with no necessary right to address the merits of the underlying conduct, but with the belief that all cases, even maybe especially attorney discipline cases, ought to be aired on their merits. If there is a theme that has to do with a failure to respond and cooperate with the disciplinary process, is that this attorney perhaps was too busy taking care of other people's problems to appropriately address his own problems, appropriately comply with his administrative duties. Mr. Steffen has been a lawyer for 31 years in the city of Dayton. No prior disciplinary problems. A particular act led to the filing of this complaint by the Dayton Bar Association, and the situation was surely compounded by the failure to respond appropriately through this matter.
Counsel, can you give us any kind of rationale for your client's failure to respond to the in this grievance process until we have the decision rendered, notification, and then we have an affidavit, in response?
Justice O'Connor, there's no good answer. There's no good answer, and we've talked about that. And Mr. Steffen's prepared to address the court if he's given an opportunity at the end of this argument. But the simple matter is Mr. Steffen, as set forth in his affidavit, had had no prior disciplinary problems. He'd had an exemplary career. He found himself in a situation where he failed to perform a service. He was informed, as the affidavit indicates, that the client got a new attorney. He never cashed a check. He never forwarded the check to the attorney who he believed would do the quadro work. And then he put the matter aside, thinking absolutely incorrectly and indefensibly that the matter had been addressed to the satisfaction of those prosecuting the claim. Unfamiliarity with the disciplinary process is no excuse, but it is what occurred here. And I would say that as we try to put that in context, we have to look at a career. We have to look at what's gone on otherwise in his career and the lack of any prior disciplinary record whatsoever.
Well, I'm a little concerned, if that's your response here, that he's unfamiliar with the disciplinary process, is cited, he becomes aware that there is a problem, and he doesn't take it upon himself to investigate what the disciplinary process is and what his responsibilities are, to talk with colleagues, you know, at least get counsel. We also have another example of an unfamiliar territory, which didn't stop him from plowing ahead in, and that was the whole issue with the Arnold case, is why he was before the disciplinary board or investigation to begin with. It seems to me that when he's unsure of what to do, he does nothing. Well, if that's an example of a 35 years of exemplary lawyering,
it's an exception. It's an exception to that experience, Your Honor. He did ultimately get the help of counsel. We ultimately had the opportunity to file our response, and we appreciate the opportunity to address those issues today. But his response is, I procrastinated. And I've asked him, and he'll tell you, how do I explain what happened here? And he struggles with that. I procrastinated. I didn't address my own concerns and what I had done wrong. But he legitimately believed, however erroneously, the client no longer had problems, no longer had issues, insofar as the client advised him that she had new counsel. He had not taken the money. He had not deposited the check. And then he had some phone conversations, the matter went forward to this stage. I would also assert, with respect to the record, although it is without any, we can't contradict the fact, and it's beyond debate, that the record's clear that he did not participate in that disciplinary process. The failure to cooperate with counsel is not a matter with the Bar Association is not a matter of record in this case. We have affidavits submitted in support of the default judgment motion, first from the client, who has nothing to say, of course, about that lack of cooperation with the disciplinary process, and then the affidavit by counsel for the relator that says, I told him there was a default judgment out there and that he didn't respond. We have no record prior to that time and no record that supports the claim that he willfully and continually ignored the process. It's hard to make that argument when at the end of the day he didn't respond and a default was taken. But the record's what's very important. It's what this court has told us in these disciplinary matters, particularly in the case of default judgments. The record is what's very important.
Mr. Leppel, let me ask you, he made some point about the fact that he did not cash the $350 check. Why didn't he return it to the former client?
The check, as his affidavit reveals, the check was set with a letter to go to an attorney who was going to do the quadro. Right. That letter and check got back in the file, was never returned.
It didn't go, but why? I mean, the client, as far as the client's concerned, that $350 check is still a debit in their account. I mean, why not return the check to the client?
It is the incident and neglect. There's no question about that.
But still, I mean, you're here today, and I guess been returned?
Well, the check, they know the check's not been honored and not deposited. I mean, check has not been handed over. That's
why
true.
Wouldn't you just send the check back so the client's got possession of the $350 instead of holding on to it and saying, well, I'm not cashing it? Well, fine, but the client still, what if he decides to cash it? A little late, probably. Probably the bank wouldn't do it, hopefully, but, I don't understand why you wouldn't. We always look to see whether the lawyer has done everything he or she can do, and this is a simple matter, sending the check back to the client.
I agree. We believe that it's been communicated through the bar that check has not been honored, negotiated, or cashed, and I don't believe the bar actually alleged that in the affidavit. We believe that was evident. That would have been a simple thing to do.
You raise it as sort of a, not really mitigation, but sort of a positive point for him. He didn't cash the check. Well, fine, but give the client her check back.
Okay, I understand your point, Your Honor. Yeah. Surely do. We've filed various motions within our objections in an effort to give every opportunity to have this matter considered. A request for remand to the board where that underlying neglect can be looked at. Most importantly, because Mr. Steffen successfully completed this divorce case. And the problem came after the completion, after the decree on the quadro issue. There's not a pattern of neglect here. There's a situation where one client is alleged to have been affected on the tail end, albeit an important tail end, of the representation.
The client had to get another lawyer and pay substantially more than the $350. She paid $1,000 plus another retainer of $1,000 plus $2,500 fee. And she had to go through the process of another lawyer and all the sorts of things that people don't like to have to do when they hire a lawyer. So she was really harmed, was she not?
Well, I see that alleged in the brief, but it's not part of the record. It's not part of the record that she paid these other fees. It was not part of the complaint. It was not part of the affidavit submitted to the master commissioner. But I'm not doubting the accuracy of what counsel would assert, but that's not part of the record either here. In fact, the master commissioner issued a recommendation based upon these facts and these findings, including apparently the belief that the $350 had been negotiated. In other words, that the attorney benefited $350 and recommended 1 year suspension stayed. Subsequently, the board accepted that report and determined, however, that in their discretion, the sanctions should be 6 months of actual time off.
Counsel, the findings of facts and conclusions of law indicate that he was practicing in a firm. Was he, in fact, practicing in a firm?
Yes.
It's sort of unusual for us to see this. I agree. We usually see this sole practitioners.
Absolutely.
and that he didn't reach out to other members of his firm. Apparently, I assume he didn't tell them about it, or they would have been all over him.
Not at that stage, but finally at a stage that brings us here today. That's correct.
His partners would have. So he didn't include them in this at all either.
They were not. The firm is an association of generally, and it's a law firm. They have an independent relationship on one level with each other. And I believe that contributed to that situation, Your Honor.
And the default judgment, at what point, he didn't cooperate, but was he, I assume, since he's at a well-known address for Dayton lawyers. Sure. He was getting the mail and was aware that events were unfolding in terms of the discipline process.
Yes.
I mean, we have and we've had from Dayton occasions where nobody really knows where the offending lawyer is.
It does happen.
Is located.
But on both sides of those cases,
right.
Your Honor, yes. And in this case, yes, he's well known. He was in a firm that's well known with good support. And it comes back to the question I was asked, how could this happen and how can we explain it? It did happen. It was a gross act of non-cooperation in this process, but it's an aberrational act by every account. The Dayton Bar Association agrees he's an attorney of great reputation and good standing in their comments. The Master Commissioner reached his conclusion, and of course, the Section 8D of the Rules of Procedure before the Board of Commissioners states that that report shall become the order of the board unless someone objects. No one objected. Nonetheless, the board enhanced the penalty, if you will, by making it 6 months of actual time off. We specifically object based upon some factual conclusions that we believe are not supported by the evidence, including the apparent conclusion by the Master Commissioner that $350 went into the pocket as a benefit to the lawyer, notwithstanding the confusion that surely results from not returning the check.
But the Master Commissioner would have no way of knowing otherwise.
Well, the affidavit was misleading upon which he relied, not intentionally, but she says, I paid him $350. And he concludes, well, he benefited $350. That's not quite what the affidavit said, and in fact, based on our affidavit, which we bring at this late date, it's an incorrect conclusion. And we think that affects the discipline that was recommended. There's no specific allegation of a Rule 5 violation for failure to cooperate, but we know that's an enhancer, so that's not a large point. Nonetheless, it is a key element of the Master Commissioner's report. There is evidence in the form of this affidavit that there was telephone contact with the investigator as well as with Mr. Tuss, albeit inadequate, insufficient. That's somewhat different than what the record suggests to us. It wasn't a wholesale turning away. It was a belief that you had addressed the situation in an absolutely inadequate way, and then a reliance that Bark somehow understood and somehow they weren't going forward with it, notwithstanding notices. That's the hard thing to respond to, but that are the those are the facts of this case. The proffered affidavit demonstrates that he unreasonably but honestly believed that he was addressing the situation, and it was unreasonable to reach that conclusion. He didn't have a copy of the motion for default in his file. We're not saying it wasn't served, and it was discussed by Mr. Tuss, according to his affidavit, with the respondent, but that's another factor. The only mitigating enhancing factor, I should say, is his failure to cooperate in the disciplinary process. By way of mitigation, we have an exemplary career. We have 31 years of service. We have a guy that we need out there servicing clients in Dayton, really a blue-collar type lawyer that has a domestic relations practice. And I know, I see that I have 2 minutes. I would respectfully request the opportunity to save that until after Mr. Tuss.
Counsel, I have one question on the recommendation of the Master Commissioner was the state suspension, but on conditions, and the conditions included the mentoring and the course of CLE and costs, of course.
Yes.
Was your client willing to engage in those conditions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they help address what the Master Commissioner called unseen and underlying, perhaps, factors here. And that's an excellent recommendation that we believe came out that would allow that monitoring if we have a problem that looks like it's more than this, what appears to be an isolated incident here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lepley.
Thank you.
Mr. Tuss.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Mark Tuss. I represent the Dayton Bar Association, the relator in this matter. We're here before the court because you are the regulator of the bar, the regulator of the profession. I'm not here because of telephone rates. I'm not here because of tort liability. I'm not here about a dispute between two school districts. You are the regulators of the bar. That's why I'm here. I also think we're here because there's a member of the public that's been harmed, and I think that's a core feature of discipline when it comes to members of the profession. Roslyn Yarnell was Mr. Steffen's client. She was a member of the public and the DBA as a, through its grievance procedure and committee. And this court has a duty to respond to that member of the public when they complain in order to maintain professional standards. That's what we're here about.
Well, so what do you think the appropriate sanction?
Well, Your Honor, excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt. Your Honor, I think what I tried to present in our answer brief is that a suspension is in order, okay? We cite kind of three groups of cases. Some of our
Was that your position from the beginning?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. The question was the time length. Some of that is internal between the Dayton Bar Association and me as counsel as to what we ultimately recommend. I think if you look at our pleadings, certainly post-answer, we've recommended a year. But something between 6 months, a year, and 2 years seems to be appropriate based on the conduct.
Was your recommendation of suspension to be stayed, or was it to be actually served?
No, actual, Your Honor. Certainly the court, again, as regulators of the profession, can impose conditions. If I could address, and this is not, it is very hard to dance by yourself in a case, all right, if you understand
that,
what I'm saying.
I had wanted is to that ask you that with, question. Is that recommendation of an actual suspension based upon the fact of non-cooperation of
down,
the respondent?
Excuse me, Your Honor. Yes, down the line, in the sense that if you look at this case from a neglect or a conduct that adversely reflects on the fitness to practice law, Mr. Steffen not only ignored his client through this domestic relations matter and her subsequent citation and contempt. Keep that in mind. This was not something where we just get substitute counsel and everything's okay. Mrs. Yarnell was cited in contempt for a matter that she thought had been taken care of. But then that ignoring, that neglect, continued with the Dayton Bar Association's investigator, its grievance committee, and even me as counsel.
But that wasn't a specific charge that the Dayton Bar filed. Was there an allegation?
No, Your Honor, it's not contained in our complaint. We've never said that.
I wondered why not.
Excuse me?
I wondered why you didn't.
That was my choice, Your Honor. If I had to do it over again in hindsight based on what has happened after the filing of the complaint, that would have been in there. It was my choice. I chose not to do it. I still think the court, under its regulations, can look at this in terms of mitigation, aggravation. Certainly, that's an aggravating
but
factor.
Other than this incident and the failure to cooperate out of this incident, you've had no pattern of this type of incident happening in the past.
No, as I pointed out in my answer brief, I think even in our motion for default, that Mr. Steffen's reputation, both as to a member of the bar and as to me personally, as a good attorney, a person with a good reputation, also no prior disciplinary matters. But I don't know that is a card that gets you out of a jam or get you out of discipline or some type of...
Well, I'm wondering about this card. I don't see any indication that he has offered to or that you have suggested that he reimburse the client for the additional legal costs for straightening up her problem that he did not attend to.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that there's any way within the rules to suggest that. I will tell you, between a colleague that you know and then you're doing a job for the Bar Association, I contacted Mr. Steffen at least once or twice, called his office multiple times, and the message was, get counsel, file an answer, do something on this case. That's the most that any colleague...
Did you talk to him personally?
Certainly, once or twice, and we know each other. We are a professional colleague.
He indicated in his affidavit that he attempted to cooperate with you and expressed his willingness to cooperate.
Well, I would say that that's an issue of dispute. The conversation, as I recall, was as set out in my affidavit that Mr. Steffen was going out of town. In that conversation, I said, Wayne, you need to, you know, pay attention to this. You need to get counsel. You need to file something, file an answer. He said he was going out of town for some seminar and that he would be back in touch with me on Monday, and I never spoke to him again about that or on that occasion. I haven't spoken to Wayne even casually on the street, you know, so it's not been something that has come up.
That raises, I guess, what should have been a threshold question, but it isn't now that we're well in the argument. He, as you know, he asks us to accept evidence that wasn't offered because this is a default matter, and to really send it back for another hearing so that he can go through what he didn't go through before by not attending to it. What you didn't, your brief didn't respond to that. What's the bar's position on that request?
Well, Your Honor, we think the matter is closed. We think the matter has been presented to the court. As I mentioned in the brief, although not in this quite the same context, is that we did not get any action from respondent until the last day to file a brief in which he was granted an extension for another 2 weeks, which then at that time he retained Mr. Lepla and filed a brief on the last day of the extension time. It seems to me that again is just an indication of the failure to follow through, and that if you wait for the last day to file your brief to ask for an extension, then something's out of sorts. So, Your Honor, we don't want to go back as the Dayton Bar Association. We think in good faith, and looking at the rules and everything else, we've tried to comply. And as I said before, it is hard to dance by yourself, because sometimes it's better to have an opponent on the other side in a case to bring out the facts. To go through a default and to try to hit all the buttons is not always so easy, and I can't read what's in his mind. What I think the court may take notice of, and which has not been revealed, but I think it's mentioned in the findings of the board, and only Mr. Stephan can reveal this or through counsel, is they talk about the failure of respondent to communicate with his client is compounded by his non-responsiveness to the disciplinary procedures, and suggests that there are tangential, unrevealed issues as to respondent and his professional status. That's something, again, I can't read a person's mind. I can't read a colleague's mind. Well, that's often not been revealed, but it's somewhat suggested by Mr. Lepla today. That often would at least be something that could mitigate what the court might do, and certainly the stance of the Dayton Bar Association.
Often in a case such as this, we see that the lawyer either has some mental condition or is suffering some personal problem that causes him or her to create this aberration in their career. I take it that there's nothing, as far as you know, I mean, nobody's argued that.
No, Your Honor, that's exactly abstract. My point. I think that there may be the hint of that, but again, no one suggested that. And again, without having an answer back or without having anything response from Mr. Stephan, what I read to you, I think, is that you wonder when a colleague that you know doesn't respond, you wonder what's going on. But I'm not here to suggest that. I'm here to represent the Dayton Bar Association, and our position is that we have a violation. We have neglect, and we have a violation of conduct that adversely reflects on his ability to be a lawyer. That's what we're asking. We think that's been shown by clear and convincing evidence, even through the default process, so we have a violation, and our recommendation for discipline is a one-year suspension, certainly a suspension, and a one-year suspension, actual suspension, without the conditions. I don't know that I'm in the position to impose those conditions. You are, as regulators of the bar. I have nothing further unless there's other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tuss.
Thank you.
Mr. Lepley, you saved a little more than a minute of your time.
The Master Commissioner does reference tangential and unrevealed issues. That's the benefit of a remand, to consider this matter in its entirety, and the Master Commissioner seemed to be asking for that in his report. The cases cited by relator are...
Well, no, wait a minute. You're here. You're representing a client. You're making an argument. The Master Commissioner is, I would assume, is looking at this and saying, here's this person who has an excellent reputation. All of a sudden, makes a mistake for a client, doesn't follow up. Probably in the lawyer alive who has practiced very much, who hasn't made a mistake or hadn't followed up appropriately for some client, but they get busy and try to make it right. You have not suggested that your client try to make it right by reimbursing his client for the out-of-pocket expenses from him dropping the ball, and you have not suggested to us that there are unresolved issues. You're asking us to give him a break, to send this back on thin air.
Well, in response, that's one option here, certainly with the affidavit.
But it's not an option we're likely to take.
I understand, Your Honor.
We hear something more from you.
Well, the affidavit sets forth his situation and how he responded, however, not appropriately with respect to the disciplinary process, and his paralysis, which is indefensible. But it's we're not suggesting, we're not looking for excuses, mental illness, alcohol, drugs, anything like that. This is an aberration, and he's wrong, and he's here, and he's making it right as best he can at a late date. And that's the big difference. The cases that the Dayton Bar cites are instances of repeated and continuing neglect. We have one instance of neglect here. We have the Witt case from 1999, which is nearly indistinguishable factually. The attorney fails to respond until there's an order to show cause. He submits an affidavit with his objections. You have an act of neglect, which I would suggest is more serious than the act of neglect here. And in that case, the court, as the master commissioner had recommended, stayed a one-year suspension. I think that's appropriate here. The goal here is to protect the public. We don't have an attorney that's out there hurting the public. We had a mistake made after a divorce was properly obtained, a mistake made. No evidence, no information ever to this side about the client incurring other costs other than a bare statement in a brief unsupported by the record. Mr. Stephan will make everything right as long as he knows who to make it right to and how much to make it right with. That's always been his position. So I don't want to say anything less than that.
But he failed to finalize the last aspect.
I would ask respectfully if Mr. Stephan would have an opportunity to address the court, if that would be appropriate.
Well, you're almost 2 minutes over time. I'll give him 30 seconds if he wants to say something to the court. It's highly unusual, but
thank you, Your Honor.
Let him do it.
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, just please accept my apology for imposing on your time today. I shouldn't be here. Mark shouldn't be here. Gary shouldn't be here. This is on me. I dropped the ball, as you've phrased it, Your Honor. I'm not comfortable being on the defensive. I'm not used to that. That's not what I've done for 30 years. But as my failure, as my initial failure snowballed, I just couldn't find it within myself to bring it to the forefront and deal with it. And it seemed like I recognized perfectly the harm that was done to Ms. Yarnell. You know, in our practice, we have difficult clients and we have good clients and pleasant people and unpleasant people. And, you know, my practice is every day in the courtroom and dealing with people. I've got to tell you, Mrs. Yarnell, during the course of the divorce, was a very pleasant person to deal with. She was a nice client, and I feel bad because I've lost her confidence, and it's all on me. And she didn't deserve this. And as far as the financial issues are concerned, I certainly would reimburse her for any additional expenses that she's incurred. I attribute this
you need to sum up, Mr. Stephan.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.